Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. And this is The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Thank you for everybody for the responses I get to the shows. If you want to respond or have a comment on any of these shows, you can always go to my website, Fader Files. That's FederFiles.com. I also put up a recent article. I went out to the movies. Yes, I actually went to the movies. I actually left my house. And went to see Bridge of Spies. So there's a movie review and a review sort of the culture of going to movies, if you want to read about that. And also, again, there's a place on the website to contact me. Today we're going to talk about two issues, one particular facet of immigration and immigrants. And we are also going to talk about one of the tools the government uses to intrude on people's lives and to perhaps violate civil liberties and to spy on us all. We have a guest today, Sue Udry, who is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the Defending Dissent Foundation. Hiya.
Good morning.
So the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is, and the Defending Dissent Foundation, two separate organizations or what?
Right. Right now we're two separate organizations, but we're merging to try to be more efficient and more powerful. And the merger should happen sometime in the next several weeks. But, yeah, we are two different organizations. Defending Dissent got started back in 1960. As the Committee to Abolish HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the Bill of Rights Defense Committee got started when the Patriot Act passed and led the movement against the Patriot Act. back in 2001.
What is the website for the Bill of Rights Defense Committee?
So the best website, we're in the process of merging our websites, and we'll be all together at one domain name, which is BORDC.org, which is the abbreviation of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
Okay, BORDC.org. And you already mentioned how long the organization has been around. I didn't know it had been around that long. And what is the basic mission? What is the mission, and what actions are being taken currently, just in general, around the country?
Well, the two organizations combined are united to some would say restore, and some would say just finally initiate the realization of the promise of the Constitution. Particularly, we focus on the Bill of Rights and the amendments to the Constitution that would guarantee free speech, free press, the right to organize and dissent, as well as our right to not be subject to government surveillance without any suspicion that we're doing anything criminal. And so what we do are a couple of things. We work to track and expose the ways that the government is using illegal or unconstitutional means to abuse our rights. And then we also work with grassroots groups around the country to pass local laws or resolutions to prevent local police from abusing our rights.
Also, do you get involved with federal legislation, too?
We absolutely do. We've got an office in Washington, D.C., and we lobby, and we also also give information to our members and supporters so that they can lobby their members of Congress on a whole agenda of bills
right.
in Congress, mostly bad, but some good bills.
So do you have volunteer lawyers on your staff? How is the organization funded?
We're funded primarily through donations of individuals and then with some foundation support. And we don't have lawyers on staff. We don't do any litigation or, you know, if you're having a problem with your local police, we don't have lawyers that can help with that. So our work is all purely advocacy, and really the way we look at it is empowering people to use their constitutional rights to defend their constitutional rights. So using the First Amendment right of speech and assembly to protect that right plus all the others that are guaranteed us by the Constitution.
What's your background? How did you arrive at the organization? I mean, what did you do before that? You know, just generally.
Well, I have a long background of being an activist and active advocate on a number of different issues. I actually got my start back in the 1980s working against nuclear weapons, and back then it was the Freeze Movement and also an organization called the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which was calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And so through the years, I've worked on a number of different issues, primarily peace and civil liberties, and I actually lived in Chicago for a while, and the Defending Dissent Foundation has a kind of a sister organization out there called the Chicago Committee to Defend the Bill of Rights, and we worked in Chicago on local and federal issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been at the Defending Dissent Foundation for, gosh, about 7 or 8 years now, because in all of my work in the peace movement and working on economic justice issues, there's always a point where there's something that the government is doing to try to diminish your right to speak out and protest and organize. And so really a key to all activism is ensuring that we're allowed to do the activism free from government interference.
Well, obviously all of this amped up, 100 times since 9/11, and especially since the Patriot Act. But let me read. There's a statement that appeared on your website recently. It says, I guess I could get through this whole thing, and maybe we could ask questions as we go along. Recent statement on the website of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and Defending Dissent Foundation. Liberty really does require eternal vigilance. It sounds like something Barry Goldwater said once, but it's a parallel.
You know, it was one of our founding fathers. I cannot remember, frankly, if it was Jefferson. I think it was Jefferson. It might have been.
That's true. All right.
Madison. Yeah.
Maybe Barry borrowed from. Liberty really does require eternal vigilance. Over the past several years, an energetic and diverse movement has established hundreds of sanctuary cities across the country to take the burden of enforcing federal immigration law off local police. It's a movement that most police departments support because it strengthens community relations and allows police to focus on crime rather than immigration enforcement. But Congress wants to put a stop to the sanctuary cities movement by withholding money from sanctuary cities. This will force police to do what their communities, you'll have to define that a little more clearly, do not want them to do, collect information about the citizenship or immigration status of people in the community, and to honor unconstitutional immigration detainers, that's in quotes, which require police to hold people beyond when they would have been released. Let me get through the rest of it, and then we can go to some questions, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, BORDC and the Defending Dissent Foundation has been part of this movement because requiring local police to enforce federal immigration law leads to widespread racial profiling, indefinite detention without due process, damage to public safety, and many privacy and civil rights violations. In July, the House passed a bill to penalize sanctuary cities, and this week the Senate, will take up similar legislation. And then there's a request here. Please help prevent Congress from rolling back the progress we've made across the country. Tell your senators to vote against the Stop Sanctuary Cities Act. So the first question, obviously, is what is we're talking about immigration here. Are we talking specifically about illegal immigrants?
Well, we're talking about it's less about immigration than it is about law enforcement and the way that they treat the people that they are charged with serving and protecting. So the idea that police need to check on the immigration status of people that they come into contact with affects everybody that they come into contact with, right? It's that the police are gonna look at you and ask you to show them some proof of citizenship. And that affects everybody, not just people who are in the country without documentation. It's generally human beings being who they are, does have a tendency to make police look more particularly at people who they perceive to be in the country illegally, which would generally be people who are Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really interesting if you talk to people who are here, say, from Ireland, who have overstayed their visas and are here, quote, illegally. They'll talk about how, of course it affects them, but the way that police treat somebody who looks white and mm-hmm. looks European is going to be different from the way that they assume that a person is here illegally if they are Latino.
So is it obviously sanctuary means providing? This is something that goes back to goes back, I don't know, 1,000 years. More.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously something that if you were accused of a crime or suspected of a crime, or in fact were a criminal and you made your way into a church, you could claim sanctuary, that you were protected by the church. So when we're talking about sanctuary here, we're talking about, and you say sanctuary cities, You mean, is this legislation that was passed by individual city councils that declared that this city, in this city, the police would not enforce the immigration laws? In other words, and does the federal government require local police by federal legislation to help enforce immigration laws?
Right. Well, there's a whole bunch to unpack there and a bunch of different rules and laws and things. And so some people actually take umbrage at the term sanctuary cities because it's not really offering sanctuary to illegal, to people who are here without documentation or, quote, illegally. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't give them carte blanche to be in the city illegally. But what it does do is kind of lessen the burden on law enforcement, local law enforcement, to be searching out and finding people who might be in the city without documentation. So
let me interrupt you a second. So local police are required by federal law to do this? I mean, or are they doing it on their own?
They're not. In general, they're not required by federal law. They're required to do a few things. One is if they book somebody, if they arrest somebody, they'll take their fingerprint, and those fingerprints are automatically shared with federal authorities. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's arrested, whether they're documented or undocumented, the federal authorities have their information, and that means that the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement knows who's being arrested. So there is this information sharing that is going on that pretty much every city does. I don't know of any city that doesn't share that information with the federal authorities. So that's one. Then number two is whether or not police ascertain the immigration status of people with whom they come in contact. And so they're, to some extent, supposed to be doing that, but they're not required to by federal law. The other thing is the issue of detainers, which is the big thing that got a lot of news this summer when in San Francisco a man who had been detained was the Department of Homeland Security requested the San Francisco police to hold on to this person while they ran checks on their background to make sure if they were in the country illegally. Mm-hmm. And San Francisco police did not honor that request.
Well, why didn't they?
They released the guy because the city. So this is where it comes in to being called a sanctuary city. The city has decided not to honor those requests because in some jurisdictions they've been deemed to be unconstitutional because it's not a judicial request. It's just some bureaucrat at the Department of Homeland Security who's saying, hey, hold on to this guy for another 48 hours, or if it happens to be over a weekend, another 5 days, another 4 days.
So there is there's no federal legislation that requires by law that local police honor these detainers?
Correct.
Okay, so it's just the federal authorities that are saying to the local police, do it or don't do it. They're saying, we want you to do this, and you're saying that there are some cities, some places, maybe you can give me some examples, that are not cooperating.
Right, and so for example, so the big one is San Francisco, but there are approximately 350 localities around the country. So Chicago, I'm sorry, I don't have a list in front of me.
No, that's all right.
Tell you exactly. So local police are. So several cities have passed, so 350 localities have passed, ordinances or guidelines or rules for their police to not honor those detainers. And what the Senate was trying to do was pass a bill that would deprive cities that don't honor those detainers of federal grants that help support law enforcement. So
This is still a threat hanging over these cities, or?
Well, fortunately, we did defeat the bill in the Senate last week. However, it's become an issue because of this. So this guy who was released in San Francisco ended up killing a young woman who just happened to be a very lovely young blonde woman who,
Everybody read about
awful.
This.
Yeah. Right. Everybody read about it, and it's become a cause célèbre among anti-immigration people who, so although we defeated it in the Senate, and I think we're good as far as national legislation, several states are taking it up. And so I know, in North Carolina, the state legislature passed a bill to withhold money from quote sanctuary cities in North Carolina, and there are five of those mm-hmm. cities who have passed these bills of not these you know non cooperation ordinances. So North Carolina, it's passed the legislature. It's sitting on the governor's desk. He has until the end of this week to sign it or not, and then. In Texas and in Michigan. In Michigan, it's going through the legislature, and in Texas, I think the legislature is actually not in session, but once it is, there's a legislator there who's going to propose similar legislation.
Well, what punishment would come from the state to these cities if this legislation, if and when this legislation is passed? I mean, how would a city suffer from the state doing this?
For the most part, it's the purse strings. It's the state can withhold money from cities.
Well, why would the police in any particular city, and give me a range of reasons or a couple of reasons, why would the police refuse to cooperate? Is it a matter of idealism or just practicality or what?
So for a lot of police agencies, the reason to not basically ask the immigration status of people that they deal with is really a community relations thing and a capacity thing. The police are there to, you know, solve domestic, you know, arrest people in domestic disputes or calm down situations or get people who are drunk driving or, you know, stop robberies. You know, that's their mandate, is to protect their cities. And when you add the rule that they are supposed to be checking the immigration status of people that they deal with, it makes people who don't have proper documentation to be here, it makes them very leery of calling the police. So a woman whose husband is, is beating her has a reason not to call the police if she's fearful that she's going to be thrown out of the country.
And I guess this would include witnesses to crimes too, right? They might not come forward.
Yeah. Right. So it really puts a damper on community cooperation with the police, and then from our standpoint, and for police also, they don't want to be perceived as profiling people racially. But if they're asking some people for their immigration documentation because they, look like they don't look like the rest of the population, mm-hmm. It really just creates a a public relations problem for them.
Well, let me ask you kind of like a devil's advocate question.
Sure.
For a long time, I worked on Sirius satellite radio, a national hookup, and I'd get calls from people. And I have a lot of, most of my listeners are what you could describe as liberal to left wing. And yet on this one issue, maybe there's a couple of different, but on one issue, immigration, a lot of people, and you brought up this case in San Francisco, on this one issue, immigration, a lot of people who ordinarily fall into the kind of the neutral to liberal or left-wing category are very exercised about this. I mean, some of them, they may have their information wrong, but maybe they don't. They're saying that immigrants, many of whom are illegal, who came into the country illegally and who are living here illegally, forget about the jobs thing. That's to me, that's easy to dispute. You know, they're taking up jobs that other people would have. Maybe it's not so easy, but I don't want to talk about that. But one reason that they say they're upset is because illegal immigrants overload the school system to the point where it can't work, or they overload hospitals and clinics to the point where they can't function. And There is a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment, and it's not just from the right wing or from people who a lot of liberals would categorize as a certain kind of person. The local police have decided to do this, obviously, for practical reasons. Why? I mean, who? Who? What is there to be done about this? And I'm beating around the bush here, I guess. There are a lot of people who, when you say local communities, it makes sense that the local police wouldn't want to do this for all sorts of reasons that you mentioned. But there is a worry in the country, and like I say, not just from one group, a particular group of people, about so many immigrants in the country overloading very old, almost broken down systems already, and insufficient systems for health and for education. I know we wandered off the topic a little bit, but this is a philosophical point. You know, an ideological point.
Right, right. which, you know, we're a civil liberties organization, and so I can't, you know, I don't, I would respond as a human being that these people are leaving countries that have been, at the short end of the stick as far as U.S. trade deals and U.S., colonialism or hegemony over the world or what have you.
Or supporting dictatorships or whatever.
Yeah. And all they're trying to do is, you know, make a living and, you know, they want the same thing for their kids as we want for our kids. And, you know, I don't know the economic arguments, except that immigrants are paying taxes, and so they are supporting, you know, they pay sales taxes, they pay employer taxes, they're paying taxes and they are supporting the services that they use to some extent, but that's beyond my depth. It's not an issue. You know, I don't work on immigration as an issue. I just work on the civil liberties.
Well, you're talking about civil liberties and
immigration.
Civil liberties and rights guaranteed by the Constitution. So basically what you're saying is that anybody who's in this country should have the same rights as anybody else, citizen or not, legal citizen or not. Should have the same protections as long as they're within the domestic borders of the United States of the Constitution anybody else should have, right?
Right. That's what the Constitution guarantees.
Okay. It didn't say in the Constitution, if you're a citizen, you have the following rights.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So
that's not true. There are some rights that are just guaranteed to citizens, but there are other rights that are guaranteed to just everybody who's here in the country,
okay.
Whether as a tourist or whatever, yeah.
So if you just tuned in, we're listening to Sue Udry, who is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the Defending Dissent Foundation. Both organizations are going to merge and have one website, but right now the website is, could you tell us again?
Sure. It's BORDC.org. That's the initials of Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
And when it comes to donations, would you like people to, I'm asking this, but I assume it wouldn't hurt, right, if people donated to your, I mean, there's a place.
We would love, yes. Mm-hmm. People can donate. People can go to our website and sign up for our newsletter or our daily news digest and just get information from us. And then you can make the decision to donate or not.
And I notice on the website there are a listing of many specific issues and localities where that involve constitutional rights and civil liberties that your organization gets involved in or is cooperating with other people or advising other people. And so if people want to see what's going on in even separate regions of the country or different states or even cities, particular cases too, they can check that out too and see if it applies to wherever they are, right?
Right. Yes.
Now, one of the issues that you were that was mentioned on your website was something called a national security letter. I think many of my listeners probably know what a national security letter is. Maybe a lot of people don't know what that is. And it's something I want to discuss with you. But first, we're going to take a little bit of a break, and then we'll come back. And is that okay? We can talk about that?
Sounds great.
National security letter. And what is this? What is it? And what does it mean? And what is it all part of? And what can be done about these national security letters if, in fact, they are intruding on our civil liberties? Let's go to some music.
Nobody knows what you mean. But if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. No use rambling, walking in the shadows, trailing a wandering star. No one beside you, no one to hide you, and nobody knows what you are. But if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. No use roaming, going by the roadside, seeking a satisfied mind. Too many highways, too many byways, and nobody's walking behind. But if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. Somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me. You would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me.
Okay, we're back with Sue Udry, who is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the Defending Dissent Foundation. Sorry about that question about, you know, immigrants and from left field there. But I guess the main question I wanted to ask was, and I recently just this Saturday, I saw this movie, The Bridge of Spies. And have you seen that?
I haven't seen it.
Well, but it's a Spielberg movie, but it's suspenseful enough. But one of the issues in there was it's all based on, you know, real events that this lawyer who was very well connected and had, you know, been a prosecutor, assistant prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. He was selected to defend a Russian spy, Rudolf Abel. This is back in the in the height of the Cold War days between Russia and the United States. And although this man was essentially very conservative, very anti-communist, and Mr. Abel was, from what I can tell, undercover and not in his country legally at all, he decided that the Constitution still protected him. So it just fascinates me that it's in a very hopeful kind of good way. It fascinates me that people would take it for granted that anybody, especially if you look at the background of why they were here. I mean, in Mr. Abel's case, he was a spy. But when you talk about people who were driven here by, starvation or dictatorships, a lot of it caused by the behavior of the United States, and they're driven here because they have nowhere else to go and no place to protect their families. why they wouldn't be granted the protection of the Constitution, of constitutional rights, is, you know, it's a mystery to me why anybody would think that. So that's why I brought that up. But national security letters, national security. What is a national security letter?
Well, these are tools that federal agents, primarily they're used by the FBI, they can use to get information from financial institutions, from internet service providers, from telephone companies. Those are the primary places. It's a demand that they can give to a, say, a phone company for your phone records, and it does not need to be approved by a judge, and it comes with an automatic gag order, meaning if I'm an FBI agent and I want to find out about you, Mike, I go to your phone company, give them a letter saying I need all this information about Mike, mm-hmm. and the only thing I'm saying with that letter is that Mike's information is relevant to a terrorist or espionage investigation.
So the company is not even allowed to say that they've been served with this letter or given this letter, and they're not allowed to discuss it or anything. They have to do this whole thing
exactly.
In secret. Okay. So
right.
Fortunately, in my case, there isn't anything that I have to say about the government that they haven't heard 1,000 times in public. But I guess that wouldn't stop them anyhow. So how is this different then? Because people are very familiar with the whole idea of FISA courts, and it seems confusing. In other words, a lot of times the authorities, that would be the FBI maybe, or the mm-hmm. National Security Agency, will go to a FISA court and ask for a warrant to do this, but the same restrictions apply. There's a gag order, and it is violating constitutional rights, according to a lot of people, according to me, anyhow.
Right.
So how is a national security letter different than a FISA court and a warrant from a FISA court?
Well, it's different because the FISA court is a court. And so although we might not be satisfied with the oversight, it is at least the executive branch going to the judicial branch and saying, hey, I want to do this. Does this pass constitutional muster? And the judicial branch says, yes, you can go ahead and demand this information. The national security letter is just an FBI agent saying, hey, I want this information, give it to me. And the FBI agent does need to get the approval of their, quote, special agent in charge, mm-hmm. which is the head of their field office. But
and it doesn't go any higher than that? It doesn't have to go to,
no.
Really? Not
exactly.
To...
So it's a pretty it's problematic for a number of reasons. It's because it's just purely the FBI making this decision, and sure, you get the special agent in charge, you know, you go up the ladder a little bit, but it's not very high up, and it's still the same agency who's saying, yeah, okay, I agree, you know, Agent Joe, you can have this information. And the other thing that is tricky and these national security letters have been around at least since 1986, but before the Patriot Act, the information that the FBI was requesting had to have specific and articulable evidence that the record that the person mm-hmm. whose records they are asking for was a foreign agent or a foreign power.
Yeah, I mean, just a general warrant for any police department or maybe even in the FISA court, that's got to be what's called, I mean, you know, it's an old thing, reasonable cause,
right?
You know, to request this and to suspect it. So you're saying there was a change or a shift in that?
Yeah, under the Patriot Act, they changed it to the records just need to be relevant to an investigation. But what we learned from Edward Snowden is that the FISA court decided that, quote, relevance you know, they gave the FBI and the NSA permission to get everybody in the country's phone records on the chance that they were relevant to an investigation. So that's really no standard at all. And yet, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice did several reports about the FBI's use of national security letters several years ago and found that even though the bar was set so low for the FBI agents to use a national security letter, and yet still they were abusing them. So it's like, hey, you can use these pretty much any time you want, but still FBI agents were abusing the power and, you know, trying to find out, you know, they wanted their girlfriend's phone records or, you know, their landlords or who knows what.
Well, when the inspector general finds these things, you know, we all read about the inspector general of this, that, or the other agency or department often issues reports of the CIA or some other place. I don't know if there's one for the NSA, but they often issue reports saying that something has been abused or greatly abused within the agency or that, and they'll name particular agents or officers of that agency that did that. But I think people are very cynical now. Nobody ever sees a change, and nobody ever, do FBI agents ever get dismissed or even arrested for violating the law?
Not that I know of, and not for their abuse of national security letters, no.
So what kind of punishment could come to an internet service provider or somebody else or a phone company? What kind of punishment could come to them if they decide that they want to say, we've been served with this? I mean, if they just want to let everybody know that we've been served with this, or that they provided information and the excuses they were served with this letter and they had no choice. You're not even allowed to say that. But what if you did say that and you were a company? What happens to you?
I am not sure what the punishment would be, but it's something bad enough that really nobody's doing it. And in fact, the reason why we are talking about national security letters now, excuse me, is because there's a case that's been wending its way through the courts for a decade where the executive of an internet service provider was fighting the gag order and saying, no, I need to be able to tell my clients that this is happening and I'm fighting it. And he just finally, after 10 years, the judge ruled, yeah, this gag order is absolutely unconstitutional.
So that's a precedent. Was that a federal judge?
Yes, it was. And of course, the Department of Justice is appealing it. It's all confused because, you know, the USA Freedom Act was passed earlier this summer, and that had some rule changes as far as the national security letter. So everything's all very confused right now as far as national security letters and the gag order. Well, not national security letters, but the gag order that comes with national security orders is in question. It's not resolved.
So what happens if I'm a phone company or an internet service provider and I get, you know, a national security letter issued to me, and it usually requests the phone records of one particular person or maybe an organization or something like that, and I say, no, you can't have it, then is involved in lawsuits come into play? Or is that a federal crime to refuse to cooperate, or how does that work?
It must be a federal crime. I don't know of any companies that are refusing. They might fight it in court. In general, your your internet service providers and your phone companies are not
right.
You're not your civil disobedience kinds of people.
But still, I mean, not that there's any more competition between these companies. It all seems to be coming like one company, but a company could lose some respect from customers. Or, I mean, I know there are people who won't use certain companies for sending email. They switch to other companies because they say some companies are more protective of their rights than other companies.
Right, you know? And some companies are more willing to fight. Fight than others, and some companies have the reputation of cooperating willfully.
If the FBI agent, let's say, legitimately has discovered that there is, let's say, what a judge would call reasonable cause, you know, and I'm an objective judge considering civil rights in the Constitution would call reasonable cause to get these records. There is some value, right, to getting these records. I mean, that's how they would determine. I mean, for all we know, the big problem is that it's all in secret. I mean, when there's darkness, anything can happen, and the public loses their rights as American citizens to understand what's going on or to reform it or to prevent it from happening. So it's the privacy that's the big problem. I mean, but on the other hand, if the FBI is doing their job and they actually are investigating terrorists, and we don't really know how many terrorism plots they may have stopped. I mean, after all, they probably stopped some, right? And they say they do. They stop many. But we're not supposed to know about it. And, of course, if they don't operate in secret sometimes, then they could blow a whole case and not be able to track people down. But it's the abuse of it and the privacy that's the problem, right?
Correct. And obviously there are some things that the public at large shouldn't know, but that's why there's the FISA court that oversees things in secret. And while we may not be satisfied with them, at least that's the judicial branch looking in on what the executive branch is doing and supposedly weighing whether or not it, complies with the Constitution.
Well, I remember reading somewhere that the FISA court approves something like, what is it, 90 or 95% of requests from the authorities?
Yeah, more like 98%.
Yeah, something like that.
But so I mean, that's the problem with these national security letters is nobody's looking at them and saying, yes, this makes sense. And the FBI agent doesn't need, you know, it's really a fishing expedition. The mm-hmm. FBI agent doesn't need to have any solid bit of evidence that the records that they're going after, that the person is doing anything wrong.
So this really does sort of chop away at the basic system of justice and civil liberties in this country. So would you just eliminate this kind of letter entirely, or would you require this letter to go to a federal judge, maybe to a FISA court kind of judge, and be subjected to scrutiny from a judge to see whether there's reasonable cause?
Well, I would, and actually, even the President's Review Commission, remember, after the Snowden revelations, President Obama set up a commission to give him advice on the different surveillance mechanisms that the intelligence community is using. Mm-hmm. And the President, and they were not a bunch of radicals, but even the President's Review Commission said national security letters are problematic and they should be subject to they should be eliminated and replaced with judicial warrants, and that this gag rule that accompanies them should be eliminated. So it's not just me.
No, I know it's not just you. It's a lot of people. Well, all this stuff that Snowden revealed is really quite extraordinary. People generally seem to take sides with Snowden. I mean, he's a hero to a lot of people, and he is a traitor to others. I mean, you know, I don't think there's anybody who's really neutral about Snowden. I mean, and he continues to reveal things, right?
Correct.
Yeah. As far as national security letters, people can if there are actions or initiatives taken by your group, how do people get involved in that about the national security letter?
Come onto our website and sign up for our newsletters and alerts. And as things progress, which they certainly will on national security letters and a whole host of other surveillance and other problems that our federal government is involved in, sign up and we'll send you action alerts and newsletter and just keep you informed on what's going on and what we're doing, and also hopefully what's going on in your local city or town that you can get involved in actually off the internet and in reality.
Mm-hmm. Actually, well, I mean, go to meetings, take to the streets, whatever, right?
Indeed. And
join.
Yes.
joining us. Yeah. So you say you do lobbying. I mean, how does that work exactly? I mean, are you registered lobbyists?
No, we don't do enough lobbying to have to be registered. But there are some good members of Congress, and we meet with them in order to try to push the envelope to pass legislation that will actually slow down, hinder the abuse of mm-hmm. our constitutional rights. And we work actually in Washington with a lot of, you know, civil liberties groups that people are familiar with. We actually have a kind of a vanguard group called the Civil Liberties Coalition, which includes the people, I guess you would say, who are on the far left and far right, who are pushing beyond what the kind of mainstream civil liberties groups are pushing for.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that with folks like Credo Mobile and Fight for the Future and Restore the Fourth and R Street, which is Republican. So it's a left-right coalition that's trying to push the envelope.
We only have a couple of minutes left. Is your organization involved with anything with the NSA, any action or initiative with the NSA?
Yeah, for sure. So we, in the beginning of, well, last spring and over the summer, we were fighting to ensure the sunset of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is the phone records, you know, that
right.
we know of as the phone, the Snowden phone record debacle, I guess. And what we're looking to now as far as the NSA, in about a year and a half, the section of the FISA Amendments Act, which is another law that gave way too much surveillance authority to the intelligence community, but we're looking at the sunset of the provision that allows the NSA to be creeping around the internet and gathering all of our data from mm-hmm. the internet. That's called Section 702. So that's the next big fight, really targeting the NSA. But we need to start engaging on it now because, of course, the powers that we're up against are so dramatically much larger than we are.
All right. Well, thank you, Sue Udry, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and Defending Dissent Foundation. And I can say by looking at the website, listeners, if you want to get an idea about what's going on in any locality that you know, that you might be involved in, this place is pretty comprehensive. They have individual cases, and they have general cases like the national security letter, but they also have individual cases involving people who have been arrested or detained in various places, or their civil liberties taken away, and fights that are being made across the country in various cities and states. So check it out, and the website is, again, what's the website?
www.bordc.org.
Yes.
That's short for Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
Okay, well worth looking at. And please, everyone, go to it. And maybe if you feel the urge, and I think you might after you go there, send them a donation. They're doing the kind of work that keeps us all free. Thank you very much.
Thanks. It was great talking to you.
Yep, same here. All right, we have, what do we got, like a couple, like 2 minutes left or something? 2 minutes left, yeah. let me just say that I actually, you know, these days I don't really, for various reasons, I don't get out too much. But I did actually go to a movie theater, which was one of those monster plexes, you know, like when there's 15 or 18 movies showing. And saw Bridge of Spies. And Bridge of Spies has got that, it's about Colonel Rudolf Abel, who was a Soviet spy, being exchanged eventually for Francis Gary Powers, who, and whether or not that exchange took place, I won't let you know unless you're aware of history. But he was a U-2 pilot, you know, spying for the United States. I guess spying isn't the right word. We would call him a patriot and risking his life. But he was shot down and detained by the Soviets, and this was at the height of the worst of the Cold War. And so this is a movie about, and it's extremely suspenseful. It is a Spielberg movie, so everything's black and white. There's a lot of patriotism. There's a lot of airbrushing of complexity and morality. But still, it's not badly done. So if you want an entertaining couple of hours, and it's all based on stuff that really happened during the Cold War. So It's about spies and dealing with possible exchanges of spies, and it's also about extending constitutional rights, which is what we were talking about today, to even people who were spying for our enemy on us, to give them the protection of rights. And I think basically we should all, for our own sake, and for if we think about our ancestors, agree that anybody who makes it to this country and who is legitimately trying to make a life for themselves or is working or paying taxes and is not, you know, actively a criminal, and even if they are, for all our own sake, they deserve protection of the Constitution. I'll talk to you next week.
'Cause I went walking, river no highway, I saw the an endless sky.
I'm